Yes, I will talk about quantum codes in two different contexts. So I will first talk about quantum codes in what we use them for, namely combating noise, and in the quantum case, decoherence. But then I will turn to foundations. I will talk about the question of where the speed up of quantum computation comes from, and there's a connection with contextuality of quantum mechanics. Encoding theory is all underneath. So it's a different application of coding theory that I'd like to mention here. So, but let's begin with the more native domain of quantum codes, namely combating decoherence. So I'll talk about fault tolerance and sparse connectivity geometry. So let me first talk about what I mean by this. So this picture looks very, very familiar. There's a planar setting, and what we can do in a setting like this is a toric code, and that's in fact what you see here. I'll be not talking about the toric code today in my talk. It's just to explain what I mean with the connectivity graph. So anyway, what you have there, if you're using the toric code for quantum memory or quantum computation, is a tiling of the plane. And your elementary tile looks like this. It has two code qubits, and if you wish, two other qubits that are used to read out syndrome. And then what you need in terms of entangling gates is just gates between nearest neighboring qubits. So in that scenario, you could call such a tile here an elementary logical unit, and then ask which other tiles it is connected to by entangling gate, and it's only the neighboring tiles, the neighboring ELUs. And then by connectivity graph, I would just replace every of these elementary logical cells by a vertex, and I would draw a line between vertices whenever two of the cells have to talk to each other, or are talking to each other, or acted upon by entangling gates. So the connectivity in this graph would have two characteristic properties. It would have a low degree, namely degree 4, and it would be planar. And we know that if we are working in such a scenario, we get good results in terms of threshold and overhead. So the highest result in terms of threshold is by Austin and company, is about 1%. And if we look at the operational overhead that's needed to do fault-tolerant universal quantum computation, it's a poorly logarithmic overhead in the size of the computation without any encoding. And well, that's typical. So what's important here is the scaling exponent, and it's 3 for the surface code, and I believe for all other topological quantum codes in the plane as well. So these parameters are good. And this is a well-studied scenario. I'm not going to talk about it today. I want to talk about a scenario which is more general. So again, we talk about a connectivity graph of bounded degree, but we are not restricting ourselves to the plane. So the connectivity graph doesn't need to be embeddable in the plane. There's no, or in a space of any fixed dimension. Okay? So in principle, there is less constraint over here, so we should be able to do something better. Okay. So now let's put some physics into the picture. So I'm talking about a specific physical architecture, which is elementary logical units that are ion traps. So our qubits are ions, and they are connected by photonic links, which establish Bell pairs, probabilistic but heralded Bell pairs between these ions. So again, we have this connectivity graph with these two properties, our vertices are these elementary logical units. So the physical basis of this, something that has been created in Chris Monroe's group over here. So here is how you actually create these Bell pairs between distant ion traps. So the qubits are ytterbium ions, And they can be in a ground state and an excited state, which correspond to the logical states 0 and 1. And in the excited state, they can decay over time and send out, by decaying, they send out a photon. And well, these photons can be collected and sent through a fiber. They can be made to pass a beam splitter, which erases the information where the photon comes from, and subsequently detected. And whenever one of these photon detector clicks, we know that we have projected the ion qubits here into a Bell state. So that's the physical basis for discussing the architecture that I just mentioned. So there is a problem with this architecture, which is that creating these Bell pairs here takes a lot of time, or well, it takes some time. And the risk is that while the Bell pair creation is attempted, everything else decoheres. So that's a problem. So we have two timescales. We have more than two timescales in this problem, in the crudest approximation, we have two timescales in the problem. We have the time which it takes on average to create the Bell pairs, and we have the characteristic timescale for decoherence. So let's call these timescales tau d for the decoherence timescale and tau e for the entanglement generation timescale. Yes?
Well, your interacting graph should still be a little more three-dimensional, no? You have to have these connections.
Yes.
There's
no length. There's no length constraint. I can afford long-range edges.
So you assume that's yeah. So fast. That, okay.
Yes. Yeah.
If you have the graph, you have to allow very long.
Yeah.
So I guess I'm probably ignoring speed of light here. Yeah. I'm not sure, but I'm, yeah. Okay, so the problem is, so what happens is if this ratio of timescales goes the wrong way? So what we want to do with this is we want to build a fault-tolerant universal quantum computer. We want to use this probabilistic entanglement generation, and well, we have this obstacle that creating those Bell pairs can take a long time. Namely, in early experiment, the average time which it took to create a Bell pair was on the order of 10 minutes, which led to a ratio of these time scales which was about 1,000. So that's clearly the wrong way. By now, this has been tremendously improved. So right now, this ratio has come down to 0.2. Which is a tremendous improvement, and you ask, well, is this good enough? This was perhaps not good enough, but when the early values came out, we were asking, is there a critical value of the ratio of this of these time scales that we need to achieve before we can think about fault tolerance? And so that's the question I want to address. Okay. And here's the outcome. There's no such threshold. You can do fault-tolerant, universal scalable computation for any such ratio. Yeah. So you need elementary logical units of a size 5 or bigger, and the result even holds if a small additional gate error is considered. Remember, in the crudest setting, we were just considering memory error due to decoherence, but the result even holds if we have a small gate error, although we need to use another construction. And in this scenario, actually there is no threshold if you look at it from a scaling perspective. You can do fault-tolerant universal computation for any such ratio, and the overhead is constant in the size of the computation. So if you want to simulate a circuit that without error correction has so and so many gates, the overhead is just a number.
But you're yeah. Upper bounding n, then the size of this ELU.
Yes, I'm upper bounding the size. Yes, I mean, if I mean, other, yeah, if there was
a theorem, but I assume that you're upper bounding that. Of course, otherwise I could just
Yeah, you could just say, I mean, yes, exactly. So without that constraint, oh, sorry, excuse me. I think it's the wrong. No, no, no. It's actually the right way around. But you can do it with 5. I mean, with
for any ratio.
For any ratio. So that is, I mean, you have if you have elementary logic, or if you have ion traps with 5 ions in them, the result says you can do it.
By 5 plus 1 that you're using.
No, 5. It includes everything. So, I mean, you can do it with 5. Maybe you can bring it down to 4. But you can, also it depends on whether you include gate error or not. But you can do it with 5.
Field. You're assuming when you get the EQRP, it's good, but then it just decoheres, but you, when it's heralded?
No, I mean, say you have a decoherence time scale of 1 second. Mm-hmm. The catch is down here. So, I mean, it's not as good as it sounds so far. Say if it takes 10 minutes, to create a bell pair and your decoherence time is 1 second, from a scaling perspective, that's okay.
You mean that's what you show?
Yeah. Yes. And I mean, it's not all that difficult to see. So if we neglect the gate error, the construction is up
but
here.
But you're saying that, you know, it takes 10 minutes to create the bell pair, mm-hmm. but, you know, you say it, when it's heralded, mm-hmm. you know, it starts out being a perfect EQR pair. And
yeah. Yes, but I mean, you may need a sequence. I mean, you need very, very many bell pairs, and also in sequence. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
Do you mean we can keep the gate error fixed, or do we have to make the gate error smaller?
No, fixed. We can keep it fixed. So I just didn't state the threshold. I mean, there's a threshold for the gate error.
Robert, just a clarification on the model. So the model is that each one of these edges that represents a photonic wing
mm-hmm.
is always on trying to create entanglement, and then there's some expected time until it succeeds.
Yes.
And that's tau sub p.
Yes.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And then there's tau d is a characteristic time scale on which it everything decoheres.
Do you assume like correlated errors?
Uncorrelated. I assume uncorrelated error.
Within ELU or within the ELUs?
You mean can be a correlated within the ELU?
Yeah, because if there is a constant link between the ELUs, I would expect it to start, you know, creating correlated errors as well.
I assume a probabilistic error model here. So there's going to be gates within the ELUs, and I assume that they are probabilistic Pauli errors, and the errors act where the gates act. And if a single bell pair creation, I mean, if there is error in the resulting bell state, I assume that this error is uncorrelated with the error in other bell states. So there is a very limited amount of correlation that I admit.
But then I would suppose that for the single ion traps, these errors have been studied a lot, right? So this is understood that this is model is applicable or not.
I mean, well, it has the same limitations as always. I mean, this is precisely the same error model that was discussed in other talks. I presume it was definitely discussed in Andrew Landau's talk. This morning. So it was the third of the error models that he discussed where every gate has an error. So, yeah.
Except that you are talking about specific architecture.
Yeah, except that, yeah. So, good. Okay.
So the threshold is kind of like maybe this was John Press was asking. The threshold is still the same for, you know, it's not like you suffer on the threshold if you have this.
No, you're not suffering on the threshold. You're suffering in the constant, in the constant overhead here, and there is where the problem lies. So this constant is exponential in that ratio. So this is actually, if I mean formally there's no threshold, but this construction immediately becomes prohibitive. I mean, yeah. So actually, I want to move on to the second part of my talk, but I'm very happy if you have more questions about it to talk about the details of the construction.
Can you just give us a hint?
The hint is here. So this is the construction for no gate error. So basically, what you want to simulate. So let's just look at the central part. So what you want to simulate is ELUs that can be connected with near unit efficiencies, say 0.9 or 0.8, whatever success probability in a fixed time step. That's what you want to simulate, and you don't have it right away. So what you do is you create these massive structures, probabilistically create these massive structures in a single step, and of course, this will almost never succeed. And if it doesn't succeed, you discard. And that's what this exponential factor comes from. But suppose you succeed, and they are created at a certain rate, then it is easy to connect them, and that's what you see over here. So they have these kind of large outer areas, and then you can, in a second step, try to connect them. And, well, connecting them once is sufficient. And if this area here, the surface area, is large enough, then with finite probability, you'll succeed. Then you, by some entanglement teleportation trick, then you connect these two ELUs. So, and you also see why this connection fails if you have finite gate error, because for long entanglement times, these structures become larger and larger, and then you're accumulating error here along that pair. Okay, but then there's another construction. But so that's the clue. That's basically the argument of how you do it if there's no gate error.
But so the connectivity is dynamical, because you have to kind of post-select on which one works and then turn around?
Yes, yes.
So if you're imagining photonic interconnects, a model that you might imagine generalizing into polarizing one would include loss. You might have photon scattering where the photon just disappears. You know,
yes.
Make it there.
Mm-hmm.
Is this robust to that, or do you have to add extra, processing to manage loss in your design?
I didn't look at it, but I wouldn't expect.
Right, but I understand. That's kind of already included in this. Yeah. That's why the time to entanglement is so long, because a lot of times the photon gets lost.
So with post, you just manage it with post selection, you're saying?
Because the heralding. Yeah. The heralding tells you when the photon is lost.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, there's other things. I think there's probably other things. I mean, it is incredibly unlikely, but I mean, what could happen is that you had two photons here, which would indicate a failure. If two photons detected would indicate a failure, but maybe your detector didn't fire and so on and so forth. So I'm not quite sure. I think it's robust, but I couldn't say it with 100% confidence. Good. Okay, so just to summarize this, from the scaling point of view, it looks nice, but no experimental table will ever be large enough to realize it. So it is, I think, at this point, an indication that the playing field is wide open here, but it's not actually a realistic construction. But anyway, I think it calls for LDPC codes, and I have come here to maybe learn from you about this scenario. And I think I just learned a little bit from Nicolas' talk. So with this, I would like to move on to the second part of my talk, which is about contextuality, computability, and speedup. So this is something entirely different. There's, at least to me, no apparent connection to the first part of the talk. I guess I have to justify sneaking it into this conference here, but there is a connection can be construed. So there is a paper that's now almost 20 years old with the title Quantum Code Words Contradict Local Realism. It shows that you can construct proofs of the quotient Speckle theorem from quantum code words. And in, I mean, in a way, we knew this for even longer. So this goes back to a Refmod Fiss article by David Merman, who presented a proof of the quotient Speckle theorem in eight dimensions, which used a GHZ state. So, I mean, in a way, the link is already there, and it was connected, was extended here in this paper. And I would like to add to this link between contextuality of quantum mechanics and quantum codes the aspects of computation. And, well, there is actually a bit of work on this subject. So, namely, there's work for two models of quantum computation. There is work on quantum computation by the injection of magic states, and that's coming out of the Emerson group next door. And there is work in the model of measurement-based quantum computation, and that work has come to the extent that I'm familiar with it from Dan Brown's group in London, and I have also contributed to this. So, yeah. So there's a difference in these two results in regards to how contextuality of quantum mechanics comes in. So over here, it is a contextuality is about speed up, is a necessary condition for speed up, which is what you would expect. I mean, quantum computation is about speed up. But over here, it is about computability. And yeah, so that's something different. And yeah, so it seems interesting to see how these two are related and how this difference comes about. I will answer that question. I will explain it to you. Okay, so, but this question, why does computability here and speed up there, I cannot resolve today, but I will resolve a technical problem towards that. And what I will resolve is this. So over here, for measurement-based computation, we know everything that we know about the role of contextuality is for qubits only for systems of qubits, nothing else. I mean, the scheme itself has been extended to qubits, but in that case, we know nothing about the role of contextuality. On the other side, up here, most of what we know is for qubits of odd prime dimension. So we cannot really compare. There's no common ground to compare. Yeah, and this is what I want to talk today at the end of my talk. So we're putting in a new scheme that interpolates between the two. And it is quantum computation by the injection of magic states. And it is for two-level system, but it is for rebits. That is the constraint here. It is for rebits. So yeah, so that's what I want to present to you today.
Sorry.
Yeah? Rebits. I mean, for states of many two-level systems, is that not a standing term, apparently? Anyway, it is for, look. It's obscure. Okay, good. So, yes, it is. So suppose you write down the density matrix of the quantum state in the computational basis. And then we require that all entries of the density matrix are real. They are not complex valued, but real valued. So that's a constraint that we have to enforce. I don't know if it is necessary, but that's the only thing that we could show something about. Yes. Yeah? Good. Okay, so here's an outline of the remainder of my talk. So that will include a fairly long review. So I would like to tell you what contextuality of quantum mechanics is. Then I will review the result that is known in the framework of measurement-based computation. And I want to be brief here, because I want to spend most of the time here. So this is results that have come out of the Emerson group. So this is for the role of contextuality in quantum computation using magic states. So that will be the review part. And then, we have to propose our extension for the case of two-dimensional system for rebits. And first we have to construct a computational scheme using rebits and magic states. Then we have to construct a matching Wigner function, a matching notion of contextuality, and then I will compare the rebit case with the qubit case. Good. So that's the program. So yeah, so let's go through some definitions. So let's begin with contextuality. Contextuality is about hidden variable models. So I need to begin with hidden variable models. Hidden variable models are an alternative description of physical reality. It's alternative to standard quantum mechanics. So let's talk about how these models work and what the basic difference to quantum mechanics is. So we can think about hidden variable models as follows. So we have a particle that would in quantum mechanics be described by a quantum state, but here the particle has something like a catalog attached to it. And the catalog says, if observable A is measured upon me, then I output the value lambda A. If the observable E is measured upon me, I output lambda B. If C is measured upon me, I output lambda C. So that's all in that catalog. So the difference to quantum mechanics is, in quantum mechanics, the outcome of the measurement is brought into existence by the act of measurement. Over here, the measurement outcome has existed all the time. It is merely revealed by measurement. And then, okay, we know here in quantum mechanics, the measurement outcomes are probabilistic, and we can mimic this probabilistic character of measurement by saying, okay, these catalogs, they come in various kinds, and they are distributed according to some probability distribution. And this probability distribution is the reason for having probability distributions of measurement outcomes in quantum mechanics. Okay, so that looks odd, but you can't disqualify it. I mean, you can't refute it just from these assumptions. Among these are valid descriptions of physical reality that are in accordance with quantum mechanics. But that changes if you make the seemingly most innocent additional assumptions. And one of these additional assumptions is non-contextuality. So let's see what that is. So we consider three observables, A, B, and C, such that A is compatible with B, and A is compatible with C. So we can measure those pairs jointly. And then we require, non-contextuality is now the following. We now require that the value lambda A that is outputted when I measure A is independent of whether I measure A jointly with B or C. So that seems a very minimal requirement, because we can measure A, and then the hidden variable model has to make up its mind what to output, and then decide later whether to measure B or C. So it seems like almost nothing, almost self-evident. However, if we make this assumption of non-contextuality, then the prediction of hidden variable models do no longer reproduce the predictions of quantum mechanics. And this is the so-called quotient-Speckle theorem, and it holds in Hilbert space dimension 3 or greater. And therefore, because quantum mechanics cannot be described by non-contextual hidden variable models, we say that quantum mechanics is non-contextual, or in a simpler way, it's contextual. Okay, so that was my summary of contextuality of quantum mechanics. So now a brief summary of measurement-based computation. Just one slide. Okay, so this is a model of quantum computation. It's universal, so everything that you can do efficiently in the circuit model, you can do efficiently here. But this is not based on unitary evolution, it's based on measurement. So what you do is you start with a suitable entangled state, as it's called a resource state, and you it's like a blank sheet of paper, and you measure the qubits in that state in certain bases, and that amounts to computation. So you tell the state what circuit to implement by choosing the measurement bases. And then from correlations of the measurement outcomes, you extract the outcome of the computation. Okay? Good. So much about, yeah, okay, so I don't want to go into detail. It's not really relevant for the talk. So the only relevance for this talk, the only thing that's relevant for this talk is the classical processing that appears in this scheme of computation. So why is there classical processing at all? I mean, in the circuit model, that doesn't need to be, but here there is classical processing because in the process of computation, you obtain measurement outcomes. And they are individually random. So you don't want to output random stuff. You want to output an output of the computation, like in the circuit model, which could be very far from random. So from this, you already see that some classical processing is going to be required. And we may ask the question, so how complicated is this classical processing? So let's look at it in a little more detail. There's two tasks of classical processing here. One I have already mentioned is the conversion of measurement outcomes into outputted bits. And the other conversion is of the input into choices of measurement bases. So it turns out that for every qubit, so we can go into, so here's a Bloch sphere. So in this scheme, we only ever measure in the equator of the Bloch sphere. So say this is x, y, z direction. We will ever only measure in the x, y equator. And there's only, for every qubit, there's only two possible choices of measurement bases. So this is phi, this is minus phi. Anyway, it's a lot of detail. Now I'm confusing myself with the picture here. So anyway, it is what we need to know. There is two possible choices of measurement bases, and they depend on the input. So we will convert m bits of input into one bit per qubit for the choice of measurement bases. And now we need to ask, so how difficult is this pre and post processing? And it turns out it is very, very simple. So all the classical processing that has to happen here is mod 2 linear. So it's just addition of bits. So this has a consequence. So this means the ability to compute linear Boolean functions is of no value, because I can do this without any quantum device. I can just do it up here with this classical control computer. Turning it the other way around, the ability to compute nonlinear Boolean functions is of value. And I can now ask the question, so what resources do I need to invest? What quantum resources do I need to invest to be able to evaluate nonlinear Boolean functions? Okay. Yes.
So, which I followed. So you said the classical processing that's required to perform the measurement-based computing is not too linear.
Yeah.
And you say linear functions are free.
Mm-hmm.
Can you stipulate that? Or can you explain why you're...
I'm saying, oh, well, I mean it the following way. I mean, suppose you had some quantum resources, meaning quantum state and a basis of measurement that allowed you to evaluate linear Boolean functions. Then you'd say, okay, look, I don't need your quantum resources. I can do that anyway. Okay. So the linear Boolean functions can be done by this classical control computer alone, which we assume is the cheap part, and this is the expensive part. So in this sense, because they can be done by this thing up here, they are cheap. Okay. So what do we do now? It sounded like a light bulb burning. Oh, good.
So,
yeah. Good. Oh, okay. Does this answer your question?
I guess so, but it seems to. So, if I wanted to eliminate the classical control computer, I wanted to do the classical tasks with the quantum device. Is that difficult? I mean, is it obvious which bases to choose when you're doing a quantum computation? It's actually a classical computation of a linear function.
So let's see. I mean, about the first part of your question. I mean, if you wanted to do this part quantum mechanically, it'd just be it would be just a bunch of C0 gates that you would insert. But that, in my opinion, that would lead you to the circuit model. if you did that, I think it would be the straight.
Within measurements, actually. I mean, I know within the circuit model.
Yeah.
Get rid of the classical computer.
Yeah.
Can you get rid of the classical computer within
the measurement? Yes, you can. Yes, you can do that. You just insert a bunch of CNOTs before you do the measurements. I'm not sure that. I mean, it's kind of a hybrid scheme, so I'm not addressing that. Yes, you can do that, but that's I'm not addressing a scenario like that. Okay, so that's the question we are asking: what quantum resources go into computing nonlinear Boolean functions? And the A answer to that question is this. So if we are dealing with qubits, then every measurement-based quantum computation that deterministically evaluates a non-Boolean function is contextual, i.e. you cannot describe the computation with a non-contextual hidden variable model. Okay. So, good. So that's the basic result we can show here. So you need contextuality to compute, to reach classical universality, to compute Boolean functions. Okay, so we can then play around with it a little bit. You may object to deterministic function evaluation here, and we can make this probabilistic. So all that is really required is that you go beyond a certain threshold in a success probability. And also for specific functions, for example, the bent functions, you can make this threshold beyond which you have contextuality, you can make this very, very small. So, well, it has to be only a tiny bit above 1/2. So if you have 1 bit of output, you can output something that is almost random, but not exactly random, and still be contextual.
I suppose that to reveal the contextuality would also be very hard.
Yes, it would be very hard. I mean, you would need to measure longer and longer. Okay, so that's what I have to say about that. And I would now like to move on to this other scheme of computation that Emerson and company have considered for the purpose of contextuality. I think the origins are, of course, much earlier than that. So there is the magic state distillation part that is due to Sergei and to Alexei Kitayev. And then, I mean, the idea of injecting states to create gates is older than that. But anyway, here is the setting. So this is now different. This is within the circuit model, very much like the circuit model, except that we do not have a universal set of gates. We have only a restricted set of gates. So that will typically be the Clifford gates, but it doesn't have to be. It's just a restricted gate set that is by itself not universal. And to achieve universality, we supplement those gates with magic states that cannot be created within here, but need to be supplemented. And, well, using the magic states, we achieve universality. So this is just not a crazy idea. So this framework is what, as of now, is the leading candidate for realizing fault-tolerant quantum computation. It gives the best thresholds and the lowest overheads. Okay, so, and now that we have the scheme of computation, we know that this stuff is not good enough here, those gates are not good enough, we ask the question, which properties must these magic states have such that they enable universal quantum computation? And there is answers to that have been found so far, and that's again by the Emerson group. We need the fact that their Wigner function must be negative, and also these states must reveal contextuality. And I would now like to explain to you what that means. Yeah? Okay, so let's talk about Wigner functions here. And to introduce Wigner functions, let's step away for a moment from quantum computation and let's think about a stone flying through air. Simple classical mechanics problem. So if I view it in classical mechanics, the stone has a definite position and a definite momentum at each moment. So there is a phase-based picture of the stone flying through air. It's just a delta distribution in this space, and it's moving as time moves forward. So now, but even a stone, in principle, is a quantum mechanical object, so we would like to have a quantum picture of this scenario, and the question is whether we can have that. So classically, again, we have a, I should say, we cannot only have delta peaks. I mean, we can have every other probability distribution because we may not know of the precise position or precise momentum. And now we want to take this to the quantum mechanical case and ask ourselves, so what's the corresponding picture? So now there is a difficulty here because position and momentum cannot be simultaneously measured. So it doesn't really make any sense to talk about a joint probability distribution. And we want to ask, so what comes the closest to a joint probability distribution? And that object is the Wigner function. So as soon, which is defined like this, and you don't need to parse it, what I want to illustrate in this formula here is that if you have the state of your system, quantum state, then you can compute the Wigner function. And I want to talk a bit about the Wigner function is a quasi-probability distribution, and I want to talk a bit about its properties. So first, let's talk about marginals. So I said it doesn't really make sense in the quantum case to talk about a probability distribution of position and momentum measurements. So the Wigner function, I mean, but if you had a probability distribution, then you could compute the marginals of it. I mean, say you could integrate over position and would get the probability distribution for momentum. You can do that too with a Wigner function, and it gives you the correct probability distribution if you do the marginals, both for momentum and for position. Okay? And the marginals, because they are probability distributions, they must be non-negative. However, the Wigner function itself can go negative, and that's not what you expect for probabilities, and that's why it's called a quasi-probability distribution. Okay, and a sign of, the negativity, because it's not what you would have in a probability distribution, is a sign of quantumness of the state. Okay, and because of that, we might ask the question, okay, what are the states with positive and negative Wigner functions? Okay, so there's a theorem about that. It's called the Hudson's theorem. So, and it is phrased in terms of the states with non-negative Wigner functions. These are the classical states. And it says that a pure state, has non-negative Wigner function if and only if it is Gaussian. Okay. So it's a very special property. So we can exactly characterize the states with positive Wigner functions. And I'll get back to that in a moment. Okay, so now let's end this detour and move back to our scenario of quantum computation. So the first step of coming back is to point out that Wigner functions can be adapted to finite dimensional state spaces, qdit, for example. And if we are looking at a qdit of dimension d, or state space of dimension d, our Wigner function would be defined on a d by d grid. So now, let's talk about definition. So here, this is a particular choice of a Wigner function that comes out of a more general class defined by Wouters, and this one has been picked by Veitch and company. Okay, so let's talk about this. So this is the definition of the Wigner function now. The Wigner function W of a state rho evaluate at a point V in phase space. So it is essentially, modulo a constant factor, the expectation value of a certain operator, AV, for each phase space point. So we have a grid like this. So to define the Wigner function, we have to talk about what these operators are. So the first thing to point out is that they are all related. They can all be obtained by translation by conjugation under a Pauli operator from the respective operator at the origin. So I forgot to say what these T's are. The T's are defined up here. They're just the Q-dit Pauli operators. So the n qubit Pauli operators. I hope this notation is clear. So first we need to talk about Pauli operators in dimension d, but it's just the usual generalization. And well, then we can use two vectors to characterize which power of the Pauli operator z you have in each local system.
And you're combining the set of x because you're using
qubits? No. Very important comment. So I'm still in the review section. So this is qdits, fully complex Hilbert space.
Okay.
And this operator would not. So whenever this part and this part would fail to commute, they would not be real. These operators would not be real. So these operators have the property that we can get them all from the corresponding operator at the origin. The only thing we need to define is the operator at the origin, and it is the sum of all these Pauli operators decorated with certain faces. Okay, and I'm going through this definition in so painful detail because the definition that I will later propose for our Rebert-Wigner function is very closely related to that. Okay, so if we assume this Wigner function, I mean, we have first the properties that we just need to have. There's a linear Wigner function is linear in the state and in the density operator. The marginals are probability distributions, and it is informationally complete. So that's minimal requirements that we need to impose, and we satisfy them. But more interestingly, there is physical properties of interest, and the first one of them is a discrete version of the Hodgson's theorem. It is from David Gross's PhD thesis. So now, a pure state has a positive Wigner function if and only if it is a stabilizer state. And now you see what this has to do with the computational scheme that I talked about earlier. So we are coming back to the stabilizer world. So we have stabilizer states in this theorem. So the natural question to ask, what about Clifford gates? So do Clifford gates play any role for this Wigner function? And it's indeed the case. So there's another theorem that's also due to David Gross. And namely, this Wigner function that I just defined here is covariant under Clifford operations. So covariant means this. So if I consider the Wigner function of any state that I like conjugated under a Clifford unitary and evaluated at some phase space point, then this is the same as the Wigner function of the original density matrix rho evaluated at some different point in phase space. So pictorially, under Clifford operations, all that happens is that the different peaks of the Wigner functions are reshuffled. That's all that happens to them. Okay, and those two statements that I just made, they have a consequence, and this is called the extended Gottesman-Neill theorem. So if I just consider quantum states that have a positive Wigner function under the evolution of Clifford gates, then I can efficiently classically simulate this scenario. So why is this called an extended Gottesman-Neill theorem? I mean, kind of underneath it works a little bit different from the standard Gottesman-Neill theorem, but why is it called extended? First, let's talk about pure states with positive Wigner function. By Hodgson's theorem, this is exactly the stabilizer states. So it, in that special case, it just reproduces the Gottesman-Neill theorem. But now we can talk about mixed states. And for mixed states, it is such that there exist states with positive Wigner functions that are not mixtures of stabilizer states. And also to these states, this theorem applies, and therefore it's called an extended Gottesman-Neill theorem. And the immediate consequence of this is that Wigner function negativity of the magic states is necessary for quantum speedup.
So would you say that if I just do Monte Carlo simulation with these probability distributions, I would get what you know?
That's underneath this is Monte Carlo simulation. Mm-hmm. Okay, so the final piece that I'd like to review of the work from the Emerson group is their notion of contextuality. So it goes like this. So it refers to earlier work, a special case of the contextuality discussed by Cabello and company. Anyway, it has a journal reference from 2014, but the preprint has been out for ages. Anyway, so the notion is the following. So we consider a bunch of projectors that in our case is projectors onto stabilizer states, because I mean the whole framework is about stabilizer states. And well, there's a certain set of them. And then I introduce a certain graph G here in this picture. And this graph is the following thing. So in the graph, the projectors are the vertices, and I draw an edge whenever two projectors are perpendicular to another. And if they are not, then I draw no edge. Okay? And now, I am looking at the maximum of the expectation of the sum of all these projectors. The maximum value that is compatible with a hidden variable model is related to this graph over here. It's called the independence number. And the way this comes about is as follows. So classically, the predetermined measurement outcomes that I would associate with these vectors would be 0 or 1. But if I have two perpendicular projectors, i.e. if the two corresponding vertices are connected by a link, then they cannot both be 1. So I must be kind of, I cannot assign zeros and ones as I please. Ones always must have a distance greater than one. And as a consequence of that, the maximum value of the sum of projectors is what's called the independence number of that graph. Quantum mechanically, I can also look at the maximum achievable value expectation value of the sum of projectors, and I mean I'm just maximizing over all quantum states here in this case, and this is also an expression that has previously appeared in the literature as the so-called Lovach-Theta number, and it can happen for suitable choice of projectors that the Lovach-Theta number is larger than the independence number, in which case the expectation value of this operator can exceed what is classically possible, what is compatible with the hidden variable model. And that we call, well, then we call the setting contextual, because it's incompatible with a non-contextual hidden variable model. So that's basically what those guys discuss here. And so now if I have a specific state, so that's what Howard and company do. Now, if I look at a specific state, such that the expectation value of this operator with respect to that state is larger than the independence number, well, that establishes contextuality, and then I attribute this contextuality to the state. So that's their way of obtaining state-dependent contextuality. They attribute this violation of the inequality to the state. Okay, good. Questions about that? So then I'm, I'm at the end of my review at least. So so we have seen a number of things. We have seen that Clifford operations on positive states and states with positive Wigner functions can be efficiently classically simulated. And also what comes out of the discussion of contextuality with respect to the previous construction is that the states with positive Wigner function are exactly the set of non-contextual states. So, and therefore I can say that both contextuality and Wigner function negativity are necessary resources for quantum computation. Okay. So that was the review. So now let's talk in my final minutes. Let's talk about our construction. So first, what's the trouble with qubits? Well, at least we can say that the definition of the Wigner function goes through, that their original Wigner function can be applied to qubits, which is not the case for every Wigner function. But what breaks down is the connection with the entire stabilizer world. So we no longer have, no longer all stabilizer states have positive Wigner function, and the Wigner function is no longer covariant under all Clifford transformations, and therefore the extended Neil-Gottesman theorem breaks down, although the original one still applies. And then also, it turns out, with respect to the previous construction, all two-qubit states, at least, are contextual with respect to stabilizer measurements, even the completely mixed state. So therefore, contextuality is no longer special. And we cannot regard it as a resource anymore. OK, and that's what we want to fix with our construction. One more thing, all these breakdowns here can be related to the Merman square. Okay, but now let me propose our construction. So we want to fix all that. We want to reestablish a Hodgson's theorem. We want to establish Wigner function negativity as a resource for quantum computation again. And the price, and we want to do this for two-level systems, and the price we have to pay at this moment is that we have to restrict our attention to rebits. That is, density matrices, which at every point in the evolution have only real entries with respect to the computational basis. Okay, so if we do that, I mean, first we have to devise universal quantum computation within that framework, and we can do that. It's not so very difficult. Then we reestablish the properties that previously broke down for the qubit case, but we have to replace something. So it's not the stabilizer states that will be singled out in this case anymore. It will be the CSS states. So the CSS states will be the states with positive Wigner function, and it's not the Clifford gates that under which the Wigner function is invariant. It is the CSS-ness preserving Clifford operations. Okay, so that's the modification that we find. Okay, so here's what we have to do. We have to first devise a scheme for computation. We have to construct a matching Wigner function and find a matching notion of contextuality. Okay, so now our computational scheme doesn't allow for all Clifford operations, but only the CSS-ness preserving ones. Okay, so I'll not go into details about this. So we have to actually set up a universal scheme of computation. The only important point is that it can be done. So you can, and that's an idea that goes back to Terry Rudolph and Luff-Grover, you can encode n qubits into n plus 1 rebits and do universal computation on that. So every quantum computation that you can do in the standard circuit model, you can do in this model. And now all we have to do is adapt that encoding to our computational scheme using magic states. Okay? So this is, again, our restricted gate sets that we can apply, and then just have to use two kinds of magic states.
CSS codes, right?
You could, but I'm not talking about fault tolerance here. I'm just talking about the computational scheme as such. But you could. Okay, so it's maybe not so important here. You can do it, okay? It's a manageable task to devise all the circuits you need. Okay, so here's the most important part. This is the Wigner function that we propose. So remember the slide of Feitsch's Wigner function. So this is now very, very much the same. So we still have the Wigner function as evaluated at phase-based points as expectation values of corresponding operators. They still obey the same relation, and we have to define the operator at the origin. And everything that's different I have shown here in red. So there's no phase factor anymore, and furthermore, the sum is restricted. And the restriction is such that the Z part and the X part of these Pauli operators must commute. Another way to say it is these operators that are admitted here have an even number of sigma y's. Okay, so for this Wigner function, we get all the goodies that I mentioned before. So we have a discrete Hudson's theorem. We have a discrete Hudson's theorem, but now for the CSS states rather than the stabilizer states, we get the covariance of the Wigner function, yeah, and an extended Neil-Gottesman theorem again. Okay, let me just not go through that. So finally, we have to talk about notions of contextuality by which we mean here, in this context, just the absence of a local hidden non-contextual hidden variable model. And so, and one thing to point out in this context is that whenever the Wigner function is non-negative, it provides a hidden variable model. So Wigner function negativity is necessary for the absence of a hidden variable model, and it's necessary for contextuality. So let me summarize. So at the end of the day, what we can show that also in this rebit setting, for this scheme of computation, by injecting magic states, the Wigner function negativity is necessary for the hardness of classical simulation, and also both contextuality and Wigner function negativity are necessary for computational universality. So that's completely the same as what we have in the Q-DIT case. But there is a difference. In the Q-DIT case, the negativity boundary exactly coincides with the contextuality boundary. And we don't know if this is true over here. So we just know that all the states with positive Wigner function are non-contextual. But in principle, there could be a region where we do not have contextuality, but Wigner function negativity. We don't know if this region exists or not. Okay, so let me summarize with the open questions. So one is the question that I started with. So why is contextuality relevant for speed up over here and for what's computable over there in measurement-based computation? And another question that came up while doing this work, covariance of the Wigner function is very prominent in all of this if we consider computation with magic states, and that's because of the Wigner function. Is covariance also important in measurement-based computation? I guess nobody has ever looked at that. And then let me come back to maybe the scope of this workshop about fault tolerance. So the questions that we could ask here is, and I don't know the answer to this question, maybe someone in the audience hears. I mean, we typically use as the restricted gate set in this computational model, the Clifford gates. I mean, but do we know any classifications? Do we know which restricted gate sets are suitable for doing computation with magic states? And well, if you could find the classification, I mean, is there, or even if you don't, but is there a favorable alternative to using Clifford gates as the restricted gate sets? Yeah. And more generally, I mean, the leading scheme today for doing fault-tolerant quantum computation is using magic state distillation. Is there something better? I don't know. I mean, this appeared, in my opinion, as a kind of an engineering solution. Maybe there's something better, maybe not, I don't know. So thank you very much for your attention. Yes?
Technical question here. CSS-ness preserving gate. How do you define, can you swap X and Z?
Yes.
Okay, but you have to swap everything?
Yes. So it's a yes. So this group is generated by the Hadamard on all qubits simultaneously, and the CNOT gates and the Paulis. Thank you.
For a few bits, I believe if you restrict yourself to these Clifford states and not magic states, you don't even get full classical computation, you get this
parity L or something like this, so you get very limited set there. Mm-hmm. Do you know how that generalizes from these two DIT models that you're looking at? Is it still just parity L, the you know, log depth circuits where you can do parity type?
Okay, so tell me again. So what would you allow in, so you would allow stabilizer states as resources for QDITs?
Yes.
And now are you getting parity L? So this goes back to the work of Bo Drap. So I mean, then you're, I would say basically yes. I mean, you're then back to the stabilizer formalism. However, we need to talk more about the conditioning. So for example, if you can choose, if it is, for example, allowed to choose measurement bases depending on classical bits that you have in your computation. So if you look at Anders and Brown's construction, it is entirely in the stabilizer formalism, but it allows you to compute something nonlinear. So I think it depends on precisely the conditions you enforce. Yes, okay.
So it is possible to define analog of Gaussian states for systems composed of fermionic modes.
Mm-hmm.
So I wonder if there is any analog of linear functions for fermionic modes. That would have the same nice properties as
I think there is. I am not familiar with it, but I think Jens Eisert is probably familiar with it. Wigner functions for fermionic systems, I think. I can't tell you anything about them, but I think Jens Eisert can. Thank you.